Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 16th of October, these are our main stories. The latest from Syria, as Russia says Turkish forces cannot advance more than 10 kilometers into the country. Joe Biden's son Hunter says he did nothing wrong in his dealings with Ukraine and China. And the new research that says stressed out mothers give birth to girls more than boys. Also in this podcast,
he started pushing her at speed and despite asking him to stop, he did not, and nobody else around intervened.
Disabled people launch a Twitter campaign against touching them without asking. That's all coming up, but we begin this podcast in northern Syria, where in just a matter of days, the map has been redrawn. The latest bout of conflict began just over a week ago when the United States withdrew its troops from the northeastern region and Turkish forces moved in to fight the Kurds. It was the Kurdish SDF, backed by America, which largely defeated the Islamic State group there. There's been international condemnation of the Turkish offensive. The United States has imposed new sanctions, but Turkey says it will pursue its military campaign with or without world support. The U.S. withdrawal has left a vacuum, which Russia has now partly filled. Moscow says its troops are there to avoid any direct contact between Syrian and Turkish forces, but it's been the Syrian regime's top ally since 2015. We'll hear more about that in a moment, but first, for more on the fighting, here's our correspondent, Mark Lowen.
Week two of the Turkish invasion, and there's no let-up. Intense battles in the Syrian border town of Ras al Ain. Turkish troops have pounded targets, but Kurdish forces have fought back. Turkey and the Syrian fighters it supports have taken over 60 miles from the Kurds they call terrorists. They've made a rapid advance, taking down Kurdish control in key areas. The Kurds have now called in help from the Assad regime, giving his forces free rein into towns they lost 7 years ago. It's compromise or genocide, said one Kurdish commander. And the pullback has allowed some Islamic State fighters the Kurds were guarding to break free. The Kurds have got other worries now. Turkey is drawing international condemnation, Britain halting new arms export licenses to Ankara, and the US has slapped sanctions on Turkish ministers and tariffs on its steel. The vice president denied that Donald Trump's decision to withdraw troops from Syria gave Turkey a green light to move in.
At the president's direction, the United States has imposed punishing sanctions on Turkey and made it very clear that that will only be the beginning unless Turkey is willing to embrace a ceasefire, come to the negotiating table, and end the violence.
Meanwhile, Kurdish fighters and civilians are dying, dozens killed in the past week. More than 10,000 Kurds have died fighting IS. This, they say, is how the West repays them. And the humanitarian crisis is building, 160,000 displaced in the last few days. Turkey's leader is pushing on, vowing to secure the region. But for old and young, in place of security, there is fresh bloodshed, fresh foes, and a deepening of Syria's nightmare.
Mark Lowen. For more on Russia's growing role in the conflict, I spoke to our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher.
This has been another coup, really, for Russia in Syria. Its backing of President Assad completely changed the dynamic of the war. It essentially changed President Assad from a man who was about to be defeated into the victor, even if a country that he's victor over is essentially destroyed and shows little sign of being rebuilt. Now, this area, the Kurds control up to a quarter of the country that had been left as a semi-autonomous region throughout most of the conflict, now has essentially fallen back into his lap. So the Russians, it's a slightly poisoned chalice. I mean, yes, they can point to it as another victory, and especially against the US. The US have pulled out, the Russians have moved, and essentially the Russians are now patrolling and essentially being there as a bulwark against the Turks, as the US were just a week ago. But of course, what Russia doesn't want and has to be very careful about is any actual direct conflict with Turkey. Now, if the Syrian army gets into direct fighting with the Turkish forces, they're going to come off a loser. The Syrian army is no match for the Turkish army. Now, what does Moscow do? Does it respond? Does it unleash its air power? Does it suddenly take on Turkey? These, at the moment, are problems that are for another day. Russia is talking very much about how it's cooperating with Turkey. It's in coordination with Turkey. It doesn't approve of the operation. It doesn't believe that it should go nearly as deep into Syria as the Turks want to, but essentially saying that it's almost under control. The two sides are now talking to each other and they're trying to avoid any direct conflict. Put this also, pictures we haven't really talked about very much because the concentration has been what's going on in Syria this week. But President Putin, where has he been this week? He's been in the Gulf. He's been in Saudi Arabia. He's in the UAE today. He's had the red carpet rolled out in a way we haven't seen since President Trump was there at the start of his administration. That's another sign of the way President Putin has stamped Russia's imprint across the Middle East, not just in Syria, but much more widely.
Sebastian Usher. A British family claimed they were thrown into a US prison as illegal migrants after taking a wrong turn trying to avoid running over an animal while on holiday in Canada. They then drove into American territory by mistake. They've called conditions in the centre disgusting. The BBC's Chris Buckler joins us with the latest.
Eileen and David Connors say they were driving in British Columbia with their three-month-old baby and other relatives when they swerved to avoid an animal. They went down an unmarked road and were pulled over by a police officer who said they had illegally crossed over from Canada into the United States. After they were arrested, they were moved to a family residential centre on the other side of the country in Pennsylvania. In an email from inside the facility, Eileen said the last fortnight had been a nightmare and had scarred them emotionally. However, she says that they have now been told that they will be going home tomorrow morning. The family say they've been to America many times and how they've been treated is insane. They've complained about the cold and dirt inside the detention centre and raised concerns about the welfare of their baby. However, Border Patrol officials are said to believe they had good reason for taking the family into custody. And in a statement, the US Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency insisted they provided a safe and humane environment for all families.
Chris Buckler. Now to the Netherlands. Police there have discovered a family of six people at a secluded farmhouse in the north of the country. Apparently, they'd lived isolated from the rest of the world for 9 years, waiting for the end of time. The newsroom's Siobhan Leahy has more details.
The village of Runewald in the northern province of Drenthe has a population of less than 3,000. According to a local bar owner there, a 25-year-old man, dishevelled, with long hair, a dirty beard and a bewildered expression, walked into his bar and ordered 5 beers. Once he'd finished them, he revealed he'd run away from home and needed help. He said that his brothers and sisters all lived together on a nearby farm, but he wanted to end the way they were living. Chris Venterbeek is the owner of the bar and told Dutch media about his encounter.
He said he hadn't been outside for 9 years. That's strange in itself, that someone comes in here and says something like that. You think, I don't know. He had no idea where he was or what he was doing. You could tell.
Afterwards, police were called and soon made their way to the remote farmhouse. There they discovered a hidden staircase behind a cupboard in the living room that led down to a basement room where the family were housed. They found six adults aged between 16 and 25 and one 58-year-old man who police confirmed was arrested and put under investigation for refusing to cooperate. This man was initially assumed to be the father, but local mayor Roger de Groot later told reporters that was not the case, and nor was he the farm owner. It's unclear how long the family had been in the basement or what had happened to the children's mother. Mr. de Groot suggested that she'd been dead for some time. A neighbour said he'd never seen any children on the farm, just one man and some animals. A local postman said it's only now he realises how strange it is that he'd never delivered a letter there.
Siobhan Leahy. Mobile phones have been buzzing back to life for the first time in well over a month in Indian-controlled Kashmir. Internet and telephone connections were all cut way over a month ago. It was said to be a precaution against insurgent communications in the troubled Himalayan region, straddling India and Pakistan. The loss of connections hit businesses hard, inevitably knocking out much of the region's trade, as well as hurting families left out of touch. Our correspondent Armir Pirzada in Kashmir has been speaking to some of those affected, and he told Nigel Cassidy more.
When we talk about business here in Kashmir, everything has been shut, like biggest industrial sectors. When we talk about Kashmir, the biggest industrial player is horticulture, that's apple trade, that contributes around 60% to the Kashmir economy. And the second sector is tourism and handicraft. Horticulture has been suffering a lot because of internet. The growers have not been able to get in touch with the buyers who are in rest of India. And transport was off the roads. A second thing is tourism, which is between 10 to 15%. It contributes to Kashmir's economy. It's shut since August 5th.
And indeed, you've been talking to business organizations.
Yes, I spoke to many business organizations. In fact, I spoke to one senior vice president of Kashmir Chamber of Commerce and Industries, Nasir Hamid Khan. He informed us about the sufferings which Kashmir economy has been going through.
The picture is very grim. It is more serious than we have ever seen it before. Firstly, we need to appreciate the stress under which the Kashmir economy already was. 4 or 5 years, we have been reeling under the impact of September 2014 floods. Then we had the 2016 disturbances. Then we had the double whammy of GST and demonetization. We had issues of connectivity, air connectivity, road connectivity, which resulted in a huge stress on the people and the economy of Kashmir.
So that's Nazir Hamid Khan giving the general picture from the Chamber of Commerce and Industry. But I know you've also been talking to a guy in carpets.
Yes, I spoke to Umar Altaf, who runs a hotel and also exports carpet from Indian administered Kashmir.
Main customer is from Germany. And I just send him the WhatsApp from photograph and all that. And they can select there and I send it. But it's very unfortunate. From 70 days, we are suffering. We are suffering. Now it's good time. After 70 days, we can do business again. But who is paying for this 70 days? Everyone suffer.
That was Umar Altaf, a hotelier and carpet exporter. So going forward, are you reasonably confident that connections will stay up, or are there likely to be further problems for people?
Things may get better, but there are many who are saying it's not going to change anything because not all mobile phones are working. Internet is totally just blackout.
Armir Pirzada, if you saw a person in a wheelchair going through a difficult doorway or struggling in some way, would you reach out and take control without asking? Probably not, but according to social media, this happens a lot with the hashtag JustAskDon'tGrab, now encouraging hundreds of disabled men and women across the world to report their experiences of unwanted touching. Some are so fed up with people manhandling them without their permission, they're now taking their own action to stop it from happening. One woman in Canada added spikes to her wheelchair to act as a deterrent after being pushed against her will. Harry Lowe is a journalist at BBC Ouch, the BBC's news platform for issues surrounding disability. He's been covering this story and he told me more about what happened.
So there's a woman called Bronwyn Berg in Canada, and she was very scarily taken along without her permission by a man in her wheelchair. And he started pushing her at speed, and despite asking him to stop, he did not, and nobody else around intervened. So after this incident, when she was in spaces with lots of other people, when she heard the sound of approaching footsteps, she started to get quite concerned. Her boyfriend, who is also a wheelchair user, designed these spikes, which he's put on the handles of the wheelchair. So they're not on the wheels, which a lot of people think when you tell them there are spikes on the wheelchair. They're on the handles. They wouldn't puncture the skin. They wouldn't harm anybody, but they act significantly as a deterrent.
How widespread of a problem is this?
I think it's a lot more common than people realise, actually. Most people are very well-intentioned. They're trying to do it to be helpful, but they don't actually ask the person that they're trying to, quote-unquote, help in the first place. And if you don't ask somebody whether they want to be helped, then you don't know whether they're actually in need of help and also what that help might look like and the best way to help somebody. So Bronwyn did say to me that sometimes she might be going up a big hill. She'd like somebody to offer help and push her up, but if she was just pushed without being asked, then she doesn't know if their intentions are good, and it's a surprise, and it can be to some wheelchair users very painful.
And what about this hashtag that's emerged? Just ask, don't grab. It's emerged on social media. Where's it come from, and what other stories have come from it?
Yeah, that was set up by a woman called Dr. Amy Kavanagh, and she had similar experience. She's a visually impaired woman, and she had people pushing her across the road, guiding her to places that she didn't necessarily want to go. And so she decided to try and encourage people to have a conversation with her before offering, again, help that she didn't necessarily need or wasn't all that helpful. So she set up this hashtag, just ask, don't grab, and loads of people have been getting in touch using that hashtag ever since. And some of the stories are, you wouldn't quite believe it. One woman here called Kirsty Farnfield wrote that pushing my wheelchair can cause injury and expensive damage to my chair. Touching me even lightly can cause excruciating pain. Whereas if you just ask somebody, you'd know that that's not appropriate for them and move on.
Harry Lowe from BBC Ouch. Still to come in this podcast.
I just wanted his approval. He's been dead for like 30 years. I'm still trying to prove things to my dad. It's crazy.
International music star Elton John on the one person close to home that he spent his life trying to impress. Hunter Biden, the son of the former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden, has denied any wrongdoing in his business dealings in Ukraine and China, though he said he'd exercised poor judgment. Impeachment investigations into Donald Trump were triggered after the president asked his Ukrainian counterpart to investigate Joe Biden, a leading contender for the Democratic nomination in the 2020 election. Hunter Biden was speaking to ABC News.
What I regret is not taking into account that there would be a Rudy Giuliani and a president of the United States that would be listening to this ridiculous conspiracy idea, which has, again, been completely debunked by everyone. Did I make a mistake? Well, maybe in the grand scheme of things, yeah. But did I make a mistake based upon some unethical lapse? Absolutely not.
That was Hunter Biden defending himself in an interview with ABC News in the U.S. Besieged in Washington by the Democratic-led House of Representatives impeachment inquiry and the critical fallout from his decision to pull U.S. troops out of Syria, it could be something of a relief for President Trump to travel this week to what has been the Republican stronghold of Texas. But could demographic changes in the red state make this less of a safe seat for the president in next year's presidential elections? Razia Iqbal reports from the annual State Fair in Dallas.
Good morning. Welcome to the State Fair of Texas. Tickets in hand, please.
Texas is big. It's around the size of France, with a population larger than Australia's. The state tourism motto is like a whole other country. And it's certainly true that those partial mythologies, cliches and contradictions are present here at the annual state fair.
Any alcohol beverages, you have to drink it or drop it.
Over 3 weeks, more than 2 million people stream to the fair from all over the state and beyond. It's brash, loud, and for more than 133 years has been hosting fair rides, art deco museums, car shows and pig races. Ubiquitous everywhere is beef. It's a $12 billion industry, and the Republican base that has kept this state red since 1980 is rooted in the farmers and ranchers of rural Texas.
If you think about Texas, we think about rural and we think of agriculture. And Texas is about cattle and cowboys. It's a big part of our culture here in the state of Texas, our heritage, but it's also a big part of our economy.
What do you make of the way in which President Trump is conducting his trade policy with countries around the world, his America First approach to things?
You know, I think you have to look at it and trust what our leaders are doing here in this country, and sometimes us at the ground level, we may not see all the intricacies of the way these negotiations are.
We put God first in our home, family second, and our animals are a real close third.
One doesn't need to go far to see more strident support for the president. Husband and wife cattle ranchers Cindy and Steve Emmons.
He's not a politician. He don't need the job. And he don't have to get along with anybody. And that's worth everything.
But in Texas, rural America is shrinking. In the last century, it's shifted from 80% rural to 80% urban. And as early as 2022, it will shift from being predominantly Anglo to overwhelmingly Hispanic. A glimpse of the state's future, beyond the Tex-Mex food, made an appearance for the first time at the fair in a puppet show, featuring large, colourful, lifelike puppets in a celebration of Latino heritage and culture. Watching the puppet show is an activist who could make a difference. Kelvin Lopez-Garcia works for JOLT, a grassroots group registering young Latino voters in the state.
A lot of the eligible Latinx people that live here in the state of Texas didn't actually go out and vote. A lot of them didn't even register to vote. So it's up to organizations like our own to start empowering as many young Latinos as possible to get involved.
Given the power that the Latin vote could have, It's quite clear that both parties are going to be vying for that vote. What sense do you have that one is prevailing over the other?
I think some of the greatest areas that matter to us as Latinos, they're the areas that, you know, the Republican Party just seems to not care about, or their solutions are not necessarily beneficial to our people. The first thing that comes out of their mouth is, oh, Trump, yeah, I don't like that guy.
That report by Razia Iqbal in Texas. Now to a new study which says women who are stressed during pregnancy are more likely to give birth to a baby girl than a boy, at a ratio of 3 girls for every 2 boys. For women who were physically stressed rather than mentally, the girl dominance was even more extreme. Evan Davis asked one of the report's authors, Columbia University's Dr. Catherine Monk, about the study.
So we actually ended up with 3 groups. One we're describing as psychologically stressed, and one group that was physically stressed, and then the healthy group. The ratio of male to females was really different based on whether you were in a stress group or in the healthy group. So you were more likely to have a female baby if you were in this physically stressed group. So you were much less likely to have a male. And that was true for actually both of the stress groups. The big difference was between physically stressed having fewer males compared to the healthy group.
Okay, you know what the next question is.
Yes, why? Well, we have some hypotheses as to why, based on prior research. So males tend to be overall more vulnerable to adversity during pregnancy, of being born preterm. And then in terms of what we know somewhat from other research, males mature more slowly in utero. So part of the thinking is that their vulnerability comes from just a more of a prolonged processes of maturation. Some work has happened on a molecular level looking at the placenta is actually a sex. So it's either a male or female sex. It comes from the fetus. And some of these genes are protective. So really placentas may differ in their capacity to protect the fetus based on being male or female.
Right. So the male fetus potentially more vulnerable. How does that get us from the stressed woman to such a big gap in boy-girl ratios?
The thinking is that the stress that we've identified is of long-standing nature, and that women often are, frankly, pregnant and have early losses that they don't know about, or they do know they're pregnant and they're aware of the loss. So what we're thinking is that women in our study who are in the stress group, they've had this stress of longstanding nature that in their prior pregnancies, they were losing males.
So effectively, it's a sex selection by
That's
miscarriage.
That's a good way to say it. No. But yes, you have it. It's a selection. there is a hypothesis within an evolutionary model that in terms of survival of the species, you don't actually need as many males as females. And the males you want to survive, you want them to be most robust, and they can father future generations with many different females.
You're not suggesting women need help with stress in pregnancy, or that stress is bad for pregnancy, or is there an underlying message here?
Well, yeah, I think there is, but a cautious one. First of all, the sex difference to us is a reflection and a reminder of how the womb is a first home and it is affecting birth outcomes. So it reminds us that the mother and her health during the pregnancy is not only important for, you know, her subjective experience, for her own physical health, but also how tuned the system is to different signals such that a male or a female would be born. The second major finding is that we do see that the stress groups are more likely to have preterm birth. And this is hugely important from a public health perspective, because preterm birth is associated with, you know, risk for future health outcomes, both mental and physical.
Dr. Catherine Monk of Columbia University in New York. The British singer Sir Elton John may have started his career singing covers of other people's hits, but he went on to become the fifth highest-selling recording artist of all time. This year, he's been the subject of a hit film, played 88 concerts, and previewed a new Broadway musical based on the hit novel The Devil Wears Prada. This week, he lifts the curtain on his career and his private life in a new memoir simply titled Me. It finds him talking candidly about his upbringing and his drug addiction in the 1980s, as he told the BBC's Mark Savage.
He may have started out recording cover versions for cheap compilation albums, but Elton John went on to become the fifth biggest selling recording artist of all time. But according to his new autobiography, Elton spent his entire career trying to impress the one person who refused to be impressed. His father.
I just wanted his approval. He's been dead for like 30 years. I'm still trying to prove things to my dad. It's crazy. But although he didn't really come to the shows or write to me a letter and say, well done, I don't think he knew how to.
Stanley Dwight was a flight lieutenant in the Royal Air Force, and Elton says he was a product of his time, uptight, emotionally stunted, and trapped in an unhappy marriage. In his memoir, the singer says he spent his childhood in a state of high alert, always on the lookout for arguments and violence. He describes himself as a shy and naive boy. So what's the connection between that child and the flamboyantly dressed extrovert we see on stage?
I grew up in the 1950s, which was a very conservative age. I knew nothing about sex. I wasn't taught about sex. That was never mentioned to me. I grew up being very shy, not being able to wear what I wanted to do, winkle picker shoes. No, they were too disgusting. So when I became Elton John, it was like a freedom. As you can see, I didn't waste any time. I went off like an Exocet missile, as they say.
From 1970 to 1975, Elton John was untouchable, releasing 11 albums containing timeless hits like Rocket Man, Eurosong and Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. His imperial phase culminated with two sold-out shows at LA's Dodger Stadium in October 1975. But Elton says he knew, as he played them, that he would never reach that peak again.
You have to realise you can't keep selling more records than you did before. Like Michael Jackson said, I want to sell more records than Thriller. And I thought, oh boy, you're in for a big fall, because, you know, Thriller was a classic record and, you know, it sold 40 million albums at the time, which was huge. And I knew after 75 that I would find my own niche and that someone else would take over.
Elton lost the rest of the 70s and 80s to drug and alcohol addiction. His autobiography paints a lurid picture of dependency, from the people he drove away to his suicide attempts. He says he was inspired to be honest in the book by his two young sons.
I wanted to write a book that my boys could read when they grew up, and I want them to know that their dad made something of his life after a few hiccups along the way.
Mark Savage. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.